Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Let's do the unconventional thing this week. Let's start by saying welcome to The Word in Your Ear podcast. I'm David Hepworth and he's...
I'm Mark Ellen.
There you go. That works perfectly. And we start off this week talking about the passing in the same week, the passings in the same week of Eric Carmen and Carl Wallinger, who, to my mind, you know, both kind of associated with the kind of nostalgic look at the great tradition of British and American pop music from the 60s and the early 70s, I suppose. You know, they're both... I tend to associate them both with enormous hits that I wasn't entirely sure actually were hits or not. Do you know what I mean, Mark? That they...
Well, Wallinger's big hit was actually sung by Robbie Williams, wasn't it? I mean, his version of it, She's the One, didn't do so well. But, I mean, the Robbie Williams one is the one that kind of made his reputation. But actually, not everybody knows that he wrote that.
Well, I'll confess, I didn't really.
Stage. No, Robbie Williams used to go on stage, rather controversially, and say that he'd written it.
That's extraordinary.
Because Robbie Williams is apparently incensed by the fact that one of his biggest hits was something that he wasn't really earning from on the songwriting side because he didn't write it. And then Wallinger was upset because although he covered it and it was a huge success, he'd said he was going to use World Party as the backing musicians. So eventually he finished up using World Party minus Carl Wallinger.
Really?
So the final nail in the coffin was to see Robbie Williams on stage claiming that he'd written the song. So yeah, quite an unruly setup.
Because in the long run, you know, the things that people value most, they value even more than the money, is credit, isn't it?
It is.
You know what I mean? It's being recognised.
Oh, absolutely.
For having done something. I mean, it must be really kind of irritating if you've written a massive hit record that you hear in every supermarket you go into, and you think, nobody associates me with that at all. You know what I mean? They associate somebody who just happens to sing it, you know. It must be very hurtful.
Galling.
It's funny, I'm thinking about this, that, you know, Frank Sinatra, who never wrote a song, went through his entire career always giving full credit to whoever wrote the song. Absolutely every time. You know, this was a song written by Sammy Kahn or whatever, or George Harrison.
But that was the tradition at the time, wasn't it? You weren't expected to write your own songs. And also, presumably by doing that, he was encouraging more songwriters to offer him material, which is
I suppose so, but it's really also he genuinely kind of venerated the songwriter's craft.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas he never claimed to have written anything at all. Whereas somehow people feel if they're singing other people's songs nowadays, that they somehow let everybody down, that they haven't been able to have that kind of inspiration themselves, which can't be right at all. But you met Carl Wallinger, didn't you? Not that long ago.
Well, it was a while ago now, but it was after he'd had his aneurysm. I mean, he became extremely ill, had his brain aneurysm, and he couldn't He had to relearn playing the guitar from the very beginning. He was really incapacitated. And, yeah, it was just around the corner from here. One of my neighbours is Carl Wallinger's wife is his cousin. And we had a fantastic evening, and he was really amazing. And he got the guitar out, and he showed me how he learned some chords again, and he played some chords. It was lovely. Interesting that he also played, I don't really know why, but he was right-handed, but he played the guitar left-handed, and he played a right-handed guitar upside down.
Oh,
I have absolutely no idea.
I can never get my head around all this. Didn't Jimi Hendrix do? Didn't he play a right-handed guitar left-handed? I think.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, partly because I think he wanted the controls, the tone controls.
Yeah.
Nearer
to him, yes.
So they were above the strings rather than below them, so he could tinker with them. But that's extraordinary, isn't it? But he was really interesting, Carl Wallinger. I think there's a real parallel between him and Eric Carmen in some ways. They're both, well, I wouldn't describe Wallinger as power pop, but they were real craftsmen, weren't they? They totally understood the mechanics of writing songs. They had a huge kind of breadth of interest. If you listen to Carl Wallinger's records, you would hear the Beatles, the Stones, the Beach Boys, Bob Dylan, Prince, Sly and the Family Stone, blues, soul. You'd hear your entire record collection. I remember when I was at Q magazine, he was one of our absolute favourites because he seemed to tick every box for Q. But he was also one of those people that you wanted, and maybe he just appealed mostly to music critics, actually, as power pop writers often do, in that they approve of all the elements that go into their songs, and they're constantly agreed that those people aren't bigger. Without taking on board, actually, that you know, as we always say on this podcast, it's a balance between charisma and talent, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the Bee Gees, 90% talent, 10% charisma. Oasis, 90% charisma, 10% talent. You know, and Carl Wallinger, good voice, not a fantastic voice. Not a wildly charismatic person. Incredibly personable, but not really a star.
Yeah.
So I think in that respect, that held him back. And I think there's a whole tradition. I was listening to Dwight Twilley last night. I was going through some old power pop. Listen to Dwight Twilley and sort of Big Star.
I've got all those records. Yeah, I've got all those records.
I love all those records. You know, and, you know, XTC to some extent. You know,
Skinny Tie music.
Skinny Tie, the DBs.
Yeah.
You know, and their groups. And maybe they just appeal to people like me. It's a bit rock critic, isn't it? That you love the idea that music comes from a different time. You kind of, when you think back to the 60s when you hear that music, because that's its main cultural reference, you know. You like the way they look, you like their Beatle haircuts or whatever. And it just seems to work, really. But, and also part of the attraction of those things is you like them because they weren't that popular, actually.
Yeah.
Were they enormously popular, you probably wouldn't like them quite
you
as
wouldn't
much.
Like them at all. Wouldn't like them
no,
at
no.
all. And no, it's funny. Eric Carmen was the leader of the Raspberries, who were obviously better known in the United States than they were here. And they had a few hits in the United States. I wouldn't say enormous hits, you know. And then later on, after a couple of people had left, their last lunge for the kind of brass ring was Overnight Sensation, you know, or the record that's called Hit Record Brackets, Overnight Sensation. Which is a song just about the whole dream of having a genuine hit record that is absolutely on the radio, absolutely everywhere, and utterly changes your life. And it's this very epic production that recalls loads of things vaguely and nothing specifically. You know what I mean? It sounds as if it calls up the shades of loads and loads of records you sort of feel are in the back of your mind. But then when you try and think of them, you think, no, those records never really existed. It's a sort of dream of the past involved in making a record like Overnight Sensation, a hit record. And it was, I think it got to 18 or something like that in the United States, which is a decent hit, but it's not life-changing. And over here, it didn't chart at all, even though radio people, and here's the parallel with rock critics and power pop, radio people love records like Overnight Sensation, Hit Record, you know what I mean? Because they give a sense of occasion to a radio program, you know, yes, what I mean? It's a, yeah, drama in the middle of a radio program or at the beginning of a radio program or whatever. Yeah. It's something you can build up to. It's something you might play again or whatever. Feels like a bit of an event. And loads of people will have liked it, but very few people will have felt, I ought to go and buy that record. Because it's sort of, it doesn't speak to normal people. It speaks to music and media professionals,
yes,
as you probably would have called them, yeah, in the past, you know. And there's a significant seam of music that's like that, you know. But I suppose, you know, on the other hand, you know, what Eric Carmen would never have imagined is that people would still be talking about that record 50 years yeah, later, you know, yeah, what I mean? Because those things just kind of live forever.
And another of the attractive things about Carl Wallinger, I think, was that he was a multi-instrumentalist. And again, we kind of like that kind of thing, don't we? Someone who can make, do his records almost entirely on his own, apart from the drums. And that appeals to music critics too. I just found an old Rolling Stone piece last night that I was looking at. And the Rolling Stone interviewer sits down to talk to Wallinger. And Wallinger goes over to a piano and he knocks out a McCartney melody. He plays Martha, My Dear, Lady Madonna, Let It Be. And then he segues into Maybe I'm Amazed, you know. And then he talks about how he's just recorded his own version of Happiness is a Warm Gun. Now, that's just absolutely classic, because Happiness is a Warm Gun is legendarily difficult, you know, ridiculous time as signatures, changing all the time. The Beatles took, what was it, 23 hours to record it, which for them was absolutely unheard of, you know. And the idea that Carl Wallinger could do all that, again, made you feel that he should have been bigger, that he was so talented, you know, because he...
Did that way of doing things arrive at a certain point? It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because if you look back at... I know, you look back at the Beatles or the Beach Boys or the Birds or whatever, any of the great groups of the 60s, there's no... You very rarely read about or hear about them saying, can we get a sound on this that sounds a little bit like, you know, kind of an old, I don't know, Smokey Robinson record from 5 years earlier or whatever? Whereas, come, I suppose, the 80s, bands go into the studio knowing that they can pretty much call up any sound that they want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So records end up bristling with quotes from earlier eras. Because you can do that, you know what I mean? And it's partly because you have people like Carl Wallinger who spent years studying that stuff in their rooms rather than playing millions of gigs, you know. They've done that stuff. They've all got their party pieces, you know, nowadays. And at the same time, you've got the kind of machinery of recording and then you start having sequences and all those kind of things, which means you can do that. You can call up any sound that you want. Whereas a band used to make just the sounds that that band in particular happened to make. Whereas nowadays, reach for a button and you can put in absolutely anything, you know. Which
there's a parallel, I think, between listening to the World Party records like Goodbye Jumbo and even listening to Oasis however many years later, in that they instantly sounded familiar. And they sounded familiar because they were familiar. They were chord sequences and they were elements and they were melodies and they were tones that were taken from records that you already had and already liked. So you were kind of, you know, you were 80% on the way to approving of them already.
Yeah. Interesting. Anyway, Carl Wallinger died last week at the age of 66, and Eric Carmen was 74.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I noticed that March 16th, which is the day we're recording, actually, is the day that Andy Fraser of Free died. He died in Abatches back in 2015. And I was just remembering how young Andy Fraser was. I mean, it's astonishing. This guy was born in July 1952, and he was playing, you know, professionally, really, when he was 13. He joined the John Mayles band when he was 15. And then, I mean, what were we doing when we were 15? My God, it's extraordinary. Just sitting around in a field, you know, drinking bottles of cider or whatever. I don't know. He wrote All Right Now and Wishing Well when he was 17. He was 18 when they played the Isle of Wight Festival. And all of that was behind, but Free was kind of over when he was 19. I mean, he left when he was 19 to form Sharks. I mean, I thought it was just astonishing, really. I'm trying to think of other people. Richie Hailins was pretty... Yeah. Who was there anyone else who was 17 when they had a hit? Stevie Winwood.
Certainly. Yeah, I remember I saw the Spencer Davis Group when Steve Winwood was probably about 16, and he'd been in bands for a while, and indeed Spencer Davis had been his teacher.
Yeah,
and so he kind of recruited him as a pupil to be in his band, and he was introduced as Little Stevie Winwood. You know, kind of tip of the hat to Little Stevie Wonder, I suppose, you know, because he was a kind of child prodigy by standards. But it's extraordinary with Andy Fraser. You know, he went on the road with John Mayall at the age of 15.
15
had to pretend that he was still having lessons. You know, while on tour, the idea that anybody would have having lessons in anything other than depravity in the back of a van with John Mayall. And Andy Fraser looked up to the steadying adult influence of Mick Taylor, who was the lead guitarist. Well, when Mick Taylor joined the Rolling Stones, he was the baby, you know what I mean? Mick Taylor wasn't an awful lot older.
He was only about maybe three years older than
Andy
Taylor,
Fraser.
I know.
I tell you the thing, we were talking about this the other day, and I went and listened to some Free records. And
you couldn't put those out there.
Well, I think, listen, it's really funny. I was listening to them, and I was really enjoying them. Boy, I was enjoying them. The sound of those records, you know, it's just extraordinary. But at one point I thought, God, I hope nobody knows I'm listening to this. Shall I draw the curtains? Would be a siren Amos outside.
With an ear to the wall.
Yeah, there's somebody coming along and saying, I fear you're having too much fun here, you know what I mean? Because the thing about Free was that at their best, they were, here's the word, lascivious.
Yeah.
Absolutely lascivious. And the thing that posterity does not remember, but I do, is that the ladies loved Free. They absolutely loved Free. All my female friends are calling Paul Rogers particularly. Paul Rogers with his tight loons and so forth, and his
t-shirt,
his hoop scoop
with flared sleeves,
hairy chest, and you know all about you know. There she stood in the street, smiling from her head to her feet, all that stuff.
Yeah,
Andy Fraser wrote in 10 minutes backstage because they needed a closer for the act, you know, which is absolutely extraordinary. But go and listen to those Free records. Well, if you dare, they're absolutely extraordinary, you know, because they're not like Led Zeppelin records or whatever. They're saucier. They're kind of dirtier.
The dirty, kind of really loose as well.
Yes.
Yeah,
you know, it's the old joke about sex isn't dirty. It is if you're doing it right.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
And now we're joined by old friend of the pod and friend of Word Magazine back in the day, the man we always sent out for when there was any major music business story that we wanted investigating. Speaking to us from the splendour of his bed, I'm delighted to say, is Eamon Ford, enjoying the best of health, but just lying in bed on Saturday morning. Is that right, Eamon?
Yeah, I feel like the granddad in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. there are three other pensioners in here, top to toe with me.
your new book, Eamon, I hate to start with this question because your book is called 1999, the year the record industry lost control. But what's it about, Eamon?
It's about a year of great chaos and great drama. So it's basically the transition year for the record industry. It's where the record industry was at its greatest moment of power, and it thought that would continue. And then external forces said, oh, that great time you're having, that's all going to fall apart. Sorry about that. Here comes 14 years of misery. Get ready. So
it's really true you say that. It's an old saying. I remember reading this years ago. The golden age of anything is an age when things behave in such a way as to make you think they will behave that way forever.
Yes,
and it'd be the same thing in the Premier League football right now. You know what I mean? Or any business that appears to be doing really well, it will not last. Now let's just go back a little bit to the 1999 is obviously the end of the 90s, but the 90s were the great boom time for the record business, weren't they?
Absolutely. The CD became the dominant format around about 1991, and it was just driving phenomenal revenues. I did some digging into the price of a CD in America, and it was around about $16, $17. An LP at that time was half the price. So you were able to double the revenue. Your manufacturing costs were less. You were also paying artists a lower royalty because the CD was a development format. So it was like every way you looked at it, the record industry were just going, this is brilliant. We're just making money left, right, and center. And it grew and grew and grew. The record industry globally, the value of it effectively doubled in about 15 years. So by the very end of the 1990s, you're talking about a global business that was worth around about $38 billion a year.
And a lot of those CDs were ones that you were buying again because you already owned them, and so therefore there was no recording cost involved, wasn't it? They're putting out Moondance by Van Morrison that already existed, so you didn't have to record it.
Absolutely, and by 1999, lots of labels were kind of holding their hands up and kind of going, yeah, those albums that we rushed out in the 80s and early 90s, we hadn't remastered them from CD. Let's remaster them again. Here's some new ideas. Here's Super Audio CD. Here's DVD audio. Just buy everything again and again, and we'll charge a premium for that. So it was like a lot of the CDs in the 1980s were just done so shoddily, and the audio quality was terrible. But the price didn't reflect that. The price would suggest that you were getting a much superior product, and you weren't. And obviously the record industry didn't care about that. They were just looking at their profit margins going, we're living in clover, everyone.
It wasn't just the record business, though, was it? Because, I can't help but recall, I mean, things like the music magazine business and so forth were doing really well out of it because, you know, those products were being sold at £15 or whatever, and therefore there was sufficient money to market them. There were fights between HMV and Virgin and R Price and all these things, out of which music media did really well. I mean, loads of people were doing really well at that time, weren't they? Not just the people in the record business.
Oh, absolutely. And obviously, all that ancillary business was happening. There was huge excitement. That had a knock-on effect on radio and TV, where music was absolutely part of the cultural fabric. And that was partly driven by the art, but hugely driven by the economics around that. You had an incredibly buoyant industry, and that has a knock-on effect for ancillary businesses. I'm sure you guys working in the magazine business, you probably were just going, we could just run a magazine full of major label adverts and not even bother writing about anything because your ad department were probably scrambling to increase the pagination to meet the demand.
Well, there was certainly a huge amount of demand, and obviously a lot of competition between retailers, which is what we forget about. You know, it was a physical product, wasn't it? Now everybody knew at varying different stages in the 90s that what they used to call new technology was coming along. Now it seems to me in your book that there were kind of two sorts of people in the record business. There were people who didn't think it was going to affect them at all, and then there were people who thought it was going to affect them, but neither of them seemed to know what to do about it. Is that fair?
I think the people who were the digital evangelists knew what to do, whether or not they had the authority to do it. was a different thing. There was one person I spoke to was a guy, Jeremy Silver, who was one of the digital senior digital people at EMI, and he talked about the clashes that he would have with like the super senior management, and he beautifully described it as it was a mixed speed economy where they were all going, the future is going this way. Then you had senior executives who were about protectionism because they were sitting on this incredible good fortune of the CD, and they were just going, this is a license to print money. And they were also bonused on not only not the number of CDs they sold, the number of CDs they shipped. So they could over-manufacture, in the millions, the CDs that they were putting out. And then they would get a bonus that year, and then they would come back, and then they would quietly kind of brush that over. Or they'd left the company, they didn't care. So they were just going like, why would you as a business go, we've got this incredibly profitable format, we can sell it for $16, $18. Why would we give that up so that people could maybe buy one song for a dollar? We're not going to give that up. So the most senior executive either didn't understand digital or thought that they could control the speed of transition, which is enormous hubris and arrogance, but that's kind of, that's part of the cocktail of the record industry, isn't it? Hubris and arrogance.
And wasn't there a moment where a lot of people didn't believe that CDs could be copied? Wasn't there a guy who played at a conference showed that you could copy a CD, and a lot of people didn't realise that was possible?
Well, the issue was, and this was something that was happening in the background, particularly around digital formats, most significantly the MP3, which was about compression. So you would say the file size for a song on a CD is going to be like 30 meg. And like the hard drive on a computer might only have been like 10 meg. And they're like, why would they, this is impossible. So the MP3, particularly the Fraunhofer Institute, who developed the codec around the MP3, were able to shrink a file size from 30 meg to 3. So it was like a considerable reduction in the file size. And they said that there was no noticeable audio deterioration. They did loads of experiments to test out. It was Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega was the song that they had to crack because it was a cappella, so like you wouldn't want deterioration in the audio quality. And they worked that out. But even then, in 1999, it was dial-up. It was still, you were talking, if you wanted to download a three-minute song, it would probably take you longer than the song's length to download it. But obviously what was happening was higher speed connections, most significantly at universities, which is obviously where Napster really took off, because you had lots of students who were tech savvy, who also had reasonably fast internet connections, and also they had very little disposable income. And then suddenly this shop window appears on the internet called Napster, going, do you want all of the music in the world for free, and you're not going to be held liable for it because it's going through your university connections? They go, absolutely, thanks very much. So all of that was happening. So yeah, certainly if you were in 1984 as the CD was being introduced to the mass market, you would have thought, like, the idea of sending that down a telephone line, are you insane? Like, it properly felt like science fiction. But 1999 was the real kind of meeting point of two big things that the record industry hadn't developed, hadn't approved, and didn't control, which was the MP3 format and the internet as a distribution system. So these were the things that kind of terrified the record industry.
All right. Tell us a bit more about that point the record industry lost control. You know, what was the control that it used to have?
Well, it controlled everything. It controlled the gateways that artists had to record companies, which would invest and build them and turn them into stars. It had a very strong relationship with the media. So if you wanted to be in a magazine or on the radio or on TV, you would need someone with leverage, i.e. a big record company, to get your name put in front of them. They had a lot of sway in terms of lobbying the government, because this was a hugely lucrative business, both domestically and internationally. They had a lot of sway over retail. At one point, EMI owned HMV, and they still had a significant share in HMV. So all of these things were different forms of control. And you also had, in late 1998, you had Seagram bought Polygram and merged it with MCA. And then, so you had what I termed the start of the era of the supermajor. So you went from six majors to five in 1999. We're now at a point where there are three major record companies controlling three quarters of the market. So they saw control through consolidation, through access to the market, through access to promotion. So they felt that they controlled the whole ecosystem, or they had enormous sway on that. And then suddenly they didn't, or it started to be chipped away. It wasn't like Napster appeared overnight and record industries crumbled into dust. It was like it was a slow decline. But they
Tell us about the artists and how the artists responded to this. You know, because loads of artists pretended that they saw it coming, or there wasn't any surprise or anything. But how have they in general adapted to these massive changes?
It was interesting speaking to people at record labels for the book. I interviewed about 80, 90 people, I think, for the book. Lots of people at record companies, and lawyers, and retailers, etc. And they said there were a number of artists who were quite prescient, because artists tend to be quite tacky, geeky people. They were kind of going, this is the internet thing. And in some cases, the artists were going to the hands of the labels going, we should be doing something with this. And it was only then that the heads of labels would listen to it. They wouldn't listen to someone in what was called the new media department. That those weird tech kids played with their internets. But then when the artists started saying, they go, right, we need, they listen to artists more than they listen to their own staff in certain cases. So you had artists who were huge evangelists for different reasons. I think probably the two most significant figures in the book are Chuck D from Public Enemy. He was out of a label contract. He went with a label called Atomic Pop, run by a guy called Al Teller, who had a long history in the record industry. And their vision was sell music online. And Chuck D saw this as a dismantling of the power and the centrality of record companies. So he saw this as an artistic form of expression. But he also saw this as almost like, in Marxist terms, the worker sees in the means of production. That was his view. He was very revolutionary about it. And he'd been talking about it since the early 90s. And then he wrote one of the chapters in the book is specifically about the Hours album that Bowie released in America, which was he released it as a paid download 2 weeks before the
physical
release.
Oh, it was a download only, wasn't it?
For the first 2 weeks. And it only sold something like 980 copies, but it was what it symbolized that was most important. And so you had a major artist and a major label making this major statement. And that obviously gave other artists the inspiration to go, well, if Bowie can do it, we should be doing it as well. So I think it symbolized a shift. And you had lots of other artists. I spoke to Mark Kelly from Marillion, who was doing
I was fascinated by the story of Marillion. They really worked at it, didn't they?
They absolutely did. They were out of a record deal, and then they realized that there was this thing called the internet where fans had fan sites. So they went on there and realized that fans said, why don't you come to America? They said, well, we can't afford it. And they said, well, we kind of fund it for you. And they effectively did. And then the band took that idea and they kind of got people to pre-order the album before they recorded it so they could fund the recording cost. And they were doing all of that stuff. People talk about 2007 and Radiohead and In Rainbows as this great skater. Nothing really that Radiohead was doing hadn't been done before by Marillion, also an EMI act. So they really understood that, okay, here's an opportunity. We're not going to sell records on the scale of Script for a Jester's Tear like we did at our commercial peak. But we have an audience out there. They congregate on the internet, and we can use that. So all the stuff now that you see that feeds into things like social media and so forth today, all of the seeds for that were happening around 97, 98, 99. And Marillion were one of the first bands to really see the commercial potential. And it was basically, well, I spoke to Mark Kelly, and he basically said it was a lifetime. We could have given up. That would have been it. And then we suddenly realized, we've got this very loyal audience. It's not the big mainstream audience anymore, but we can still have a career.
Yeah. Hey, that's one of the things that struck me is that with the internet, you no longer disappear. And you used to disappear, you know what I mean? When you were no longer in a record company contract, your record got deleted, you just disappeared. Nobody disappears any longer, do they?
Yeah, absolutely. And everything was available because, like, certainly in the CD reissue period, not every album was remastered for CD or made available. And generally, it might be like your classic album or your greatest hits. And then the Napster, one of the big things that Napster proved was like there is a demand for everything, and that's not just stuff that has never been digitized for release digitally, but also stuff that has never been released commercially. So studio outtakes, demos, live recordings. And now you see that now with like every Beatles reissue album now has to have 5 extra discs of John Lennon demos or George Harrison noodling a guitar or a slightly different version of Octopus's Garden or whatever. And that was because they'd identified by the late 90s that the audience want this stuff. So they used to have to go to record fairs and ask this man to kind of whisper and kind of go, got any bootlegs? And then he would pull out an album in a brown envelope and it would just be terrible Bob Dylan demos that had been just badly dubbed onto cheap vinyl or whatever. But not everything was available digitally. It could be circulated digitally. And now we're at a point where there's whatever it is, 70 million songs on Spotify, which was inconceivable in 1999. Yeah, it was this, they had that phrase, the celestial jukebox, that had been kicking around since the 70s, and this was it. But also the issue was this was a celestial jukebox where you didn't have to put coins in to play the music, which obviously the record industry, the record industry liked that there was Chris Anderson called the long tail, that everything eventually would find its own audience. But they wanted every bit of that tail to be monetized, and digital threatened that.
Yeah. So, final question. If the record industry lost control, are there gatekeepers nowadays?
There are, but I think the idea of the gatekeepers were there was a gatekeeper system set up for a single mainstream. So you had magazines that would be tipping off radio, which would tip off TV. So that everything was leading towards the same single mainstream. The idea of the mainstream, I think, in music doesn't exist anymore. We saw that just this week when one of the Glastonbury headliners was announced as SZA, and loads of people are going, I've never heard of, who is this person? And I was going, like, if you look at her biggest song on Spotify, Kill Bill, has had 1.7 billion streams. She's the 14th most streamed artist in the world on Spotify. And as a friend said, if you don't know about SZA, that's not a SZA problem, that's a you problem. But the idea of like this unified, obviously you'll have artists like Beyonce or Taylor Swift that everyone knows about, but you will still have enormous artists like SZA that will be deemed big enough to headline Glastonbury, and loads of people are going, I've never even heard, I don't even know who this person is. So that idea of a single mainstream doesn't exist, which is interesting and good in a way, but I guess it's also terrifying in a way in that does culture lose something if we don't have the same talking points? We're not all watching the same TV shows. We're not all aware of the same artists. We're not all watching the same films. Maybe it's great in that it's a democratization of consumption, but I think also just maybe culturally, the threads that we hold in common aren't what they were. But then also, it also means that more artists get in front of more audiences. But then within that is that if you're level in the playing field, suddenly everyone gets onto the playing field and not everyone can kick the ball. So that's a terrible analogy. But the idea that it becomes getting in front of an audience is easier than it's ever been. Making money out of that audience is harder than it's ever been.
It's never been easier to play. It's never been harder to win, as we frequently reflect. Eamon, lovely to talk to you. Best of luck with the book. Turn over and go back to sleep.
Terrific. Yes. Don't let us keep you up any longer.
Yes, I'll blow out my candle and my wee willy winky hat.
Lovely to talk to you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Eamon Ford's book, 1999, The Year the Record Industry Lost Control, is published now by Omnibus Press. That's easy for me to say. It's a very absorbing read, actually, particularly if you've been involved in any respect at the music business. In that period, you know, record company, retail, publishing, promotion, whatever, is all covered. It's absolutely fascinating. And loads of stories within it, actually.
Oh, yeah. He mentions one of the high points, I think, of the record industry. So 1997 was the copies of Be Here Now came out by Oasis and sold, I think, was 690,000 copies in 3 days. And you think that's an amazing thing. And as you say, it was a boom time, wasn't it? The money that went into advertising, the money went into supporting magazines, radio, everything.
Well, also the money from the public, you know. I mean, yeah. when was The Bodyguard, the Whitney Houston film that Nick Lowe famously had What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Standing on the soundtrack of? And that's in the 90s, isn't it? And yes, it is. That sold in America 1 million copies in a week. Which is just
astonishing. I remember Nick Lowe said he got $1.1 million, didn't he? It was his first check. I think he's had more since.
Well, yeah.
That was his first check. And that was in 1991. Incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, the 70s actually took place in the 90s. You know, what people think of the boom years of the record industry. Well, not the 70s, it was the 90s. So, released and this week in 1982. So how many years is that ago, Mark? That's 42 years ago. Yeah. My goodness. The original Linda Thompson, Shoot Out the Lights, which was the final original Linda Thompson record. And subsequently went down in history as a divorce album, which I don't think was entirely fair, really, because they toured quite a while after they made it. And that was a very acrimonious tour between the two of them, and it was the final time.
Terrible tensions on stage.
Terrible tensions on stage.
There was a theory that Joe Boyd had that Richard Thompson had written some of those songs for Linda to sing after he had left her. Did you hear this?
Oh, I didn't.
An extraordinary idea. I mean, whatever. It's one of those cases of a record where the two people involved in the drama that they're singing about are in the same room physically putting that record together. And that's just agony to think about, isn't it?
But I listened to a lot of that record yesterday, and it wouldn't terribly strike you that it was particularly a divorce album. It became identified in the public mind with divorce. And once you've done that, it's very tempting to look at it that way, to listen to it that way. Because I was thinking also, one of the other records that's obviously seen as a divorce album is Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. Now, you'll be more of an expert on that one than I am. But, you know, it's never particularly struck me like that while listening to it. And I would have thought it's perfectly possible for people to listen to that and never twig the fact that it's supposed to be about a particular breakup with a particular woman.
Well, it's about the disintegration. I don't know about divorce. It's about the disintegration of a relationship, isn't it? I'm trying to think of the lines now. You idiot wind, your corrupt ways have finally made you blind. I can't remember your face anymore. Your mouth has changed. Your eyes don't look into mine. I mean, it's pretty tough stuff. This is the guy who wrote Sarah and who wrote Sad Eyed Lady is now writing, you know, Idiot Wind Blown Sarah, Through the Flowers
Sarah's
on Your Tomb.
Sarah was on the record before, wasn't it? Is that right?
I think it was.
But it was Desire's the record.
Could not have been more love-struck.
They'll do anything for a song, you know.
I know.
There's, it's funny. I was thinking, again, I listened to Blood on the Tracks yesterday and... Do you know, I'll tell you a funny thing about Blood on the Tracks. How many records has Bob Dylan made? An awful lot. And
in the 40s? Can't remember.
Okay, in the 40s. And I would say, let's say there's 40. I would say there's 30 that at one stage or another in my life while listening to them, I thought to myself, I love this record. You know, and I think that's a very important part of your relationship with the record. You know, you might not think it all the time, but there will come times when you're listening to it and you're particularly in the appropriate emotional state, or sufficient drink has been taken, or God knows what, to actually think, God, I love this record. Yeah? Is that part
of... Oh, absolutely,
that's part
yes.
of the record. Okay, I've thought that about nearly all Bob Dylan's record. I have never once for a second... thought it about Blood on the Tracks. I've always found Blood on the Tracks slightly cold.
It's cold. It's harsh.
I've always thought Blood on the Tracks, this is the record that was put out to please the record company.
Yeah. Record company got Idiot Wind on it, which is very, great. Very hard to listen to.
It's got loads of words in it. They love it. It's what people who kind of... people who read about Bob Dylan a lot and then went and listened to him. That's what they wanted. You know what I mean? It's very kind of.
It's not literary. Got the warmth.
There's no warmth. There's no humour. There's none of the things that make you like Bob Dylan that make me love Bob Dylan.
Which really matter. It's like we in this house, we love Nashville Skyline. Now, obviously, it's not a classic, but the great thing about it is it's so optimistic, and it's so buoyant, and it's so funny. You know, it's so warm.
I can listen to Planet Waves and think, I love this record. Mm. I love this record. Tough Mama from, you know, Planet Waves. You know, the oddest things of Bob Dylan, I absolutely love. But something about, you know, Blood on the Tracks, I just find cold and calculated. And I find it impossible to love. Anyway, further divorce albums.
Oh, divorce record, Tunnel of Love. Oh, my Lord.
Tunnel of Love.
Tunnel of Love is an interesting one, I think, because when Bruce Springsteen married, what was her name?
Julianne Phillips.
And she was a kind of model and actress. And all that, you know. And you always thought of Bruce Springsteen as being a bit of a regular guy. And I think the general consensus was that he'd had his head turned somehow and that this was an unwise thing and that they were somehow might prove to be incompatible. So that record, I think, is really sad. When he just sort of, you know, it's a brilliant disguise, things like that. When they just doesn't know quite who he's married, and it's all happening very much in public. And if this falls apart, there'll be a load of people going, "I told you so." There's an element of that, I think.
I can't help but thinking he must have written one of my favourite Bruce Springsteen songs, which I don't think he does a very good version of. The best version is by Southside Johnny, which is a song called "All the Way Home." And whenever I think about that period of Bruce Springsteen's life, I think he must have written that song during that time because it opens with the line, "I know what it's like to have failed with the whole world looking on."
There we are, that's it.
"I know what it's like to have been so sure and to wake up and find it all gone."
Yeah.
It's a brilliant, brilliant song.
Yes.
And his version of it is nothing like as good as Southside Johnny's. Southside Johnny just identifies something in the song that Bruce Springsteen
doesn't recognize. Yes,
it's
absolutely.
A brilliant song. But anyway, and the interesting thing about Tunnel of Love is there's only one little credit on that record, one little thing. Thanks, and it just goes, "Thanks, Julie." It's like, well, at least I got an album out of it. Because he divorce settlement, you know, God knows how much she got. She must have got a lot of money. But neither, I mean, and she will have got a lot of money out of his highest earning part of his career, because that was when he was doing, you know, these massive world tours. And, you know, so she might have taken half of that or whatever. But neither of them has ever said a word about it since.
No, they haven't.
Although he wrote about it in his autobiography, but perfectly sympathetically, isn't it? Neither of them have said an unkind word about each other ever since. So I think it's quite remarkable, really. But talking of unkind words, I'll tell you another record I listened to yesterday again. Are you familiar with Marvin Gaye's Hear My Dear?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
the deal was, wasn't it, that he's splitting up with Anna Gordy, the daughter of his record.
No, not the daughter, his sister.
Sister of
Berry Gordy.
And the deal was that...
Who is 17 years his senior.
Yes.
So he'd married a woman 17 years his senior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm sorry, that's weird. That's weird, particularly if you're Marvin Gaye in the late 60s, whatever. That's weird. But she was the driving force behind his career. And then he kind of, he left her to go and set up with a woman who was 17 years old, who then had two children by him. How weird is that?
This is weird about a minute.
And so, you know, the idea is that he had to make this record in order to give her the money for the divorce.
Half of the royalties were going to go to her. So the whole thing was that he was going to go in there and just knock something out. But actually really got involved in it, didn't he?
Yeah, but he it was a flop record. You know, half the royalties of that not worth having at all.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like Let's Got to Get It On or Diana and Marvin or whatever. And it's a kind of strange record. It's in many ways a kind of classic Marvin Gaye record. So it hasn't got any songs on it. You know, it's Marvin Gaye kind of making Marvin Gaye type vocal noises and fabulous backing and so on. And then odd lines kind of swim into focus. And one of them that struck me yesterday was, you can leave, but it'll cost you. Gives you an idea of the forces at work in that record. Another one that was a divorce album that people don't realize is a divorce album is Carole King's Tapestry. Because, you know, she'd
split up with Goffin about, what, 2 years before?
But not even 2 years. The record before Tapestry was called Writer. And it was her first proper solo record with A&M Records. And he co-wrote... You know, so those are all Goffin King songs on Writer.
Yeah.
But come Tapestry, they're not, apart from You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, which had already written, obviously, a few years earlier. So she either wrote the songs entirely herself or wrote them with Tony Stern. Tony Stern, who was a kind of fascinates me, he's a kind of Hollywood scene maker. One of those people like, what's the name of the guy who wrote the lyrics for God Only Knows with Ryan Wilson? Is it Tony Asher? Tony Asher, it was an advertising man, I think. Just Ryan Wilson would like somebody to write some songs with him. Oh, yeah, I can do that, you know. And obviously earned money out of it forevermore. Tony Stern, you know, co-wrote a load of those songs from Tapestry that carried on selling for absolutely for decades. But that is very much a kind of record of here I am on my own. And so it is an extraordinary story, isn't it? That Carole King writes all these songs during the 60s with a husband and then says, okay, I don't need you anymore. I'm off on my own. At which point in a normal story, it would all crash and burn. But it didn't. You
Precisely
know,
the opposite.
Absolutely
yeah.
The other way. Yes,
it's too late and stuff like that. About
yeah.
It. Oh, it's brilliant.
And Frank Sinatra.
Oh, in the Wee Small Hours.
In the Wee Small Hours.
Even that title, I think, is brilliant. It's that idea of being away. It's like the moment in Your Cheating Heart by Hank Williams. The idea of being awake at night, racked with the complications of your life. Because it was Ava Gardner, wasn't it?
Well, it's Ava Gardner. Well, there'd been Nancy, his first wife, Nancy. Then he quickly married Ava Gardner and then very, very quickly divorced.
Yeah, yeah.
And don't you think it's absolutely amazing that Frank Sinatra who we all know, you know, was a byword in popular music for the ready availability of sex to famous, you know, to famous pop singers. You know, he wrote the book on that, didn't he, really?
Yeah.
You know, that when Robbie Robertson joined Ronnie Hawkins, he said, "You won't get much money, but you'll get, forgive me, more pussy than Frank Sinatra." You know what I mean? So Frank Sinatra was the kind of top of the tree as far as those things were concerned. At which point, he repositioned himself as the guy who was unlucky in love.
Yeah, unlucky and wounded.
It's all gone wrong for Frank.
I need your sympathy. Yeah, exactly.
You think, if it's gone wrong for Frank, what's it like for the rest of us?
Yeah.
There he is in the bar in the middle of the night.
But also writing those kind of records about relationships going wrong, it kind of humanizes you, doesn't it? I mean, I think face value by Phil Collins. But I mean, that part of the reason that record was so successful, it was all about kind of being fallible and human and hopeless. And, you know, before that, what had there been? Attack of the Giant Hogweed or whatever, and things that you couldn't really relate to, you know.
Yeah, it's got "If Leaving Me Is Easy," hasn't it? Coming back, "If Leaving Me Is Easy," coming back is harder. And it's worth saying, while we're talking about Phil Collins, it's worth repeating, those early solo albums are fantastic.
They're really good. They sound beautiful too.
So good. He commanded so many styles. He's such a winning singer, I think.
Yeah.
Phil Collins. And of course, Amy Winehouse's "Back to Black."
That's a sad record.
That is a genuinely sad record.
Oh my lord!
Because you'd watch the whole affair unfold in the public prints, hadn't you?
And
you
didn't. It's terrible.
You didn't have to be a marriage guidance counsellor to know that one was going to go pear-shaped.
You're listening to the Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
Time for a few readers' letters. Various people getting in touch, some from Australia, actually, Mark, suggesting that I should be listening to Stone Age Romeos by the Hoodoo Gurus.
Well, we were either a bit dismissive of it or a bit nonplussed by it, but we did a little piece of me last week about whether or not March the 9th, I think it was, 1984, was the worst ever in the history of the UK album charts. I mentioned the Hoodoo Gurus as being not terribly exciting, but then again,
there's always somebody you say, "No, listen, you're probably right.
Fair enough.
I've got the record. I will play it at some point."
Absolutely.
It's one of the characteristics of loving pop music that there's always a kind of minority voice there. You know, it's like Danny Baker always says, you know, whenever you say, "That record is absolutely terrible," somebody will always go, "It's got one good track."
I think you'll find if you give it time. Listen to it 6 or 7 times, it'll eventually sink in.
I know, you're right.
But anyway, thanks for that. And I can't remember, we're talking about oldest performing acts, and James Maxwell Smith. Actually, I should have mentioned who got in touch with us. Paul Conn from Canberra in Australia, and P.D. Turner talking about the Stone Age Romeos. And James Maxwell Smith points out, once again, we've said it before, but you can never say it too many times, the oldest performing artist that we know of is Marshall Allen of the Sun Ra Orchestra, who is 99, ladies and gentlemen, still touring. So next to him, Willie Nelson is an Andy Fraser, kind of 14-year-old, just arrived in the van. Sorry, what were you going to say, Mark?
I was going to say Paul Jorgen Backer from Norway also wrote in about, we've done that thing about groups that we liked that had a certain narrow sound that we found very comforting, like J.J. Cale. He said he thought the Fountains of Wayne was in the same place. Fountains of Wayne, actually, someone we should have mentioned earlier on in our thing about, you know, those kind of music critic groups that tick all the boxes and
they
understand the craft. And also, Fountains of Wayne have got that thing that all those groups got of appearing slightly above it all, slightly above the game and slightly knowing, but also desperate for a hit at the same time, you know.
Yes.
But what wonderful records they made, Fountains of Wayne. They're just...
Oh, God, yes.
But again, there isn't that kind of charisma element, is there? There's no kind of...
No, but what there is... No, there is none of that charisma. But what there is, and it possibly a compensating factor, is their relative lack of success lends them a poignancy.
It does.
That lasts. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
you always feel you're sticking up for the underdog when you say something about the Fountains of Wayne in a way that you can. It would never be the same case
it's
if you so talk
true.
About the
Bee Gees. You never
have
a conversation with anyone about the Fountains of Wayne without being a slight sort of shrugging and a slight kind of, what happened?
Yes,
it's not my fault. I loved them. I bought all their records, you know.
What happened? I happened to find a list this week. Let me see if I can find it. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to forgive the tapping on my keyboard here as I try and find the... Yes, this is The Wire. The Wire, the kind of avant-garde, jazzy kind of magazine. And they did a list some years ago, I think, and I only just came across this list this week. And I was intrigued. It's The Wire's 100 records that set the world on fire, open brackets, while no one was listening, close brackets. Which is a kind of classic music magazine idea, you know.
It is.
Nobody else was listening, but we were. And so number one, I've got it in front of me, was Nandi Po by Pierre Akendengwe, which I have to confess I've never heard. And the second one was Shooting at the Moon by Kevin Ayres and the Whole World, which I was only listening to the other day. In Greenwich Village by Albert Eiler. Anyway, go down this long list. And it's full of interesting stuff, no doubt very challenging stuff. But amongst them, I noticed that they've got Dr. John's Grigri Gumbo Yayo, or whatever that record was called. And the idea that nobody was ever listening...
I think quite a lot of people listen to that.
A lot of people listen to that record.
Yeah, yeah,
John Beale used to play it absolutely all the time. And I knew loads of people who had that record. But it's just, it spoils the story if you can't say nobody heard it, you know what I mean? Because being underrated or unjustly passed over is a huge part of the mythological value, isn't it?
It is. That's what makes them so attractive.
Yeah.
All the interest in Judy Still was that Judy Still, that nobody apparently got to ever hear her. You know?
Yeah, we did. Everybody heard her. They just didn't buy the album.
A lot of them just didn't quite get around to buy a copy, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't quite connect.
So further correspondence, Matthew North, and we're talking about, I can't remember where this came from, and talking about groups, the decline of the group.
There are no groups anymore, that's right.
But he said that's not the case in heavy metal, because this is in the world of heavy metal, nothing has ever really changed, and it just carries on regardless of any social media fads or anything else. So that may well be true. Talking of things that go on forever, we were talking the other day to somebody who I don't think I've seen since I saw him in Northern Italy in 1987, and that's Fish. At the time, Fish out of Marillion, but since then he's been Fish in his own right for about 40 years.
He's good value, wasn't he?
We had a fascinating
a really interesting guy, you know. And also, one of those people who appears to be, well, let's see if he still sticks to it, he appears to be genuinely retiring and going for a completely different life, although he already lives on a farm and stuff. But he has bought, with his wife, 35 acres of a remote Scottish Outer Hebridean island with a croft on it, part ownership of a 3-mile beach, which has just been voted the best beach in the world, and with a herd of sheep who are named after, was it the
Hibs team in 1972.
Fantastic. And I just thought, that is great. He's going to go up there, just mend a few fences, go to the pub at lunchtime, go and look at his sheep, have a swim, strum a mandolin, and then have a three or four fingers of fire water in the evening. What fun. And go to Cayley's.
Then open a branch of the Groucho Club on the beach.
It was a lovely story about him meeting a girl at a Cayley, wasn't it? Who was called Cayley.
Absolutely.
And it was so lovely. And he thought, well, I wonder if there's any connection here. And he said, why are you called Cayley? She said, this girl didn't recognise him. Said, my mother used to really fancy the lead singer of a group years ago, the group called Marillion. Imagine that. Imagine that happening in your life. You're the reason I'm called Cayley.
Anyway,
it's worth listening to. It's really good.
Very definitely. And that'll be posted sometime in the next few days. Bye-bye.
See you next week.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.